We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. One thing we know is that every day in the news, there are many different economic issues discussed and a lot of economic terminology. And our feeling was that maybe these things aren't always terribly well understood, or maybe it was our feeling that we don't understand them as well as we should. So we thought we'd like to try and do some programs here and have some economists on the program and talk about some of these basic things. And as I sat down and started reading through recent stories about the economy, two things that come up again and again are the budget deficit and the federal debt. What we should do about it, how concerned we should be. And certainly that's a big topic of conversation these days in Washington. So we thought, well, that would be a place that we could start. Certainly, it is the case that in round figures, the U.S. budget deficit is now about $1.3 trillion, and it is the second biggest deficit that we've had since World War II. And there are many people today in Washington who think that we should move very aggressively to reduce that deficit. Other people say, well, deficit reduction certainly is important over the long term, but big cuts in spending now might do more harm than good. So we want to start out here trying to talk a little bit about the deficits and whether they matter and what we should do about them. And we have two guests here with us on the program, both of them from the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Charles Kahn, he's professor in the College of Finance, professor of finance in the College of Business. And Ann Villamil, she's a professor of finance and of economics in the College of Business. And we're pleased that both of them could be here to talk. Now, we, of course, welcome questions from people who are listening. We hope that people will try to be brief. That way we can get in as many different callers as possible and get a lot of input. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having us.
We appreciate it. I guess, in starting out, I talked a little bit about the budget deficit. And with that and the debt, I think as I look at different people writing about it, I see some different numbers. But I guess in round terms, the deficit we're talking about is by 1.3 trillion. Maybe some people say it's 1.4 trillion. Maybe that's when you're talking about numbers that big, that's maybe not a very big difference.
Pocket change.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But you think that pretty much that's what it is that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's then ask a basic question. That all right? What is that? That when we talk about the budget deficit. What are we talking about?
So, you know, budget deficit is actually a pretty easy concept. It's just the difference between what you're spending and what you're taking in. Mm-hmm. So that's the concept is easy. The solution is difficult because it involves either raising taxes or cutting expenditures to bring us back into balance. And so, economists always distinguish between two kinds of budget deficits: a structural deficit and a cyclical deficit. So a cyclical deficit occurs when there's a recession, because when you have a recession, expenditures on unemployment and other types of programs naturally go up because people lose their jobs, and we provide those kinds of expenditures. And also taxes go down, because as people lose their jobs, taxes are a function of income. Their income goes down. They're not paying taxes. So economists, you know, in some sense, expect to see deficits occur during a recession. A structural deficit is when there is a fundamental imbalance between spending and taxation. Mm. Right? And so we plug deficits of both types by issuing bonds. And so these accumulated deficits lead to a debt.
So I think this is right here. This is important, and again, maybe a little complicated. But I think that the issue of structural deficit is mm-hmm. something that we probably don't talk about as much as we should. We've had, I think, a few conversations here on this program with people talking about the structural deficit that we have here in the state of mm-hmm. Illinois, And on the federal level, it's the same issue. And I think that if people can get the concept pretty easily, if they think of two lines, which you could plot out on a graph, one line would be the money coming in.
Mm-hmm.
The other line would be the money going out.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at how these two things are projected to go over time, you can see that those spread between those two lines, the money coming in and the money going out, over time, it's true in the state of Illinois, it's true for the federal government, the spread between those gets bigger and bigger and bigger as you go out. And that's the concern, maybe more of a concern than the year-to-year deficit, that is, when we look out 10 years, 20 years into the future, how far the spread is between what's coming in and what's going out.
Right, right. And, you know, the important thing about deficits, first of all, when you're projecting deficits out, projecting out 10 years, 20 years certainly is very unreliable. So therefore, we start talking about rates of growth of things. And those things are actually, there's always pain when we make these adjustments. But when we start adjusting rates of growth, then over time we can see these lines starting to converge again rather than diverge. But again, the basic issue is we have to cut rates of growth of expenditures and we have to increase taxes in order to bring this in line. And we can do that by a lot of ways. So when I say cut rates of growth of expenditures. For example, things like raising retirement ages. People don't like this. They think I was entitled to retire at a certain age. But if you change retirement ages, that can have a very big effect on bringing things into line.
And one of the difficulties with thinking about this is that while you're thinking of things in terms of these long-run issues, the noise that's going on at any particular time is about what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it looks like you're trying to do one thing in the long run and the opposite thing in the short run, political problems start arising from that. Are you being consistent? And you actually are, but it's hard to make that case clear.
Well, that's also, I guess, what people are going to, again, it's confusing because there are people who say, yes, it's true that the debt is important. And this is something we should be chipping away at. At the same time, they say, but at a time like the time we're in now, federal spending is a good thing. And so maybe we shouldn't be quite so worried. We should be willing to spend money now, even if that means that we have a current deficit, because that's good for trying to rise all the boats right at the moment. But at the same time, what we have to do is say, but we still do have this commitment for dealing with, eventually getting to deal with the debt, and that we should actually even say how it is we think that we're going to do it.
And that's why the notion of a distinction between a structural debt and a cyclical debt is so, a structural deficit and a cyclical deficit is so important, because that's a good way of gauging whether or not adjusting for the temporary imbalances you're on the right path or not.
Right. And also, you know, another way to say what you're saying is that we need a sustainable plan. So we can say that we might want to do some things now, but here's what's going to happen in the future, mm-hmm. because we have to pay for these things.
And that's actually a fairly tricky thing to do, because that goal has been tried in the past with all sorts of promises that push comes to shove just are not are either not feasible or too difficult to maintain in the short run.
Yeah. Well, I guess I want to come back to the subject of deficit. From year to year, I guess you would say, people would say, from year to year, well, yeah, we need to be concerned about the deficit because that adds to the mounting debt. So, yeah, we ought to have some commitment to dealing with the debt. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, how worried do we need to be about the, so now we've got $1.3 trillion deficit, or maybe it's $1.4 trillion. I mean, how worried about that do we need to be?
Well, markets tell you a lot about how worried you need to be about things. And the U.S. has been able to borrow a lot at attractive rates right now to sustain this deficit. But there's concern that won't go on forever. We can look Europe. We're talking about major developed European countries, some of which are seeing very large spreads, very large increases in the rates at which they could borrow. Now, you know, the U.S. is in a favorable position in the following sense. If we want to raise our taxes, we have the capacity to do so. By world standards, our taxes are actually pretty low. But there's a very serious political debate about what they should be.
How just – let me continue with that question about the ability of the United States to borrow.
Mm-hmm.
How worried should one be that at some point – the countries that are willing to lend us money and invest in it, literally they're investing in the United States, so they're lending us money. To this point, I guess there's been a fair amount of confidence in the prospects for the United States and its economy, so people continue to be willing to do that. Is there a real reason to be worried, though, that at some point some of the countries, and I suppose China would be the biggest one, might say, well, you know, we're just really not so sure about the United States anymore. We've lent the United States an awful lot of money, and we're just not going to do it anymore. Is that really something to be worried about?
I think it's structural versus cyclical again. If the U.S. were not able over the course of a decade to get its house in order, then you start worrying about things like that. On a year-to-year basis, I don't think it's a serious worry.
Right, I'm not worried about that either in the terms of the U.S. being shut off. But, you know, prices always do move to clear markets, and in terms of borrowing, we're talking about an interest rate, and so interest rates could go up, and that would be another drag on the economy. I think people don't appreciate now, for all the concern there is in the U.S. economy, interest rates are actually quite low, and that makes it easier to service debt. If interest rates go up, that would be a problem for the U.S. We'd have to devote more of the revenues that we do have coming in to servicing debt, and that would be a real drag. And we saw that in the 1980s. In the 1980s, interest rates spiked.
And we're seeing it probably now with state and local debt as well, which seems to be on the verge of having interest rate increases as well. But
right.
That's not happening at the national level yet.
Right. But when those problems occur, they often occur quite dramatically, right? So markets can very sharply adjust and sometimes overreact.
Okay. Let me introduce our two guests, Anne Villamel and Charles Kahn. They both teach here at the University of Illinois. They're economists, and we're talking about some basic economic issues. And we thought this is likely to be the first of some number of programs we want to try to do. And if people have thoughts about things they'd like us to be talking about, we're certainly open to suggestions, not necessarily here during the program, but you can always send us an email or give us a call. And we thought a good place to start would be with the two big issues that we seem to be talking about an awful lot now, and that is deficit and debt. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller to start us off, someone in Indiana, and it's line 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The question I'm going to ask, I hope it makes sense. Many times I'm listening to economists talk, and one economist is for one position and the other one's for another. And he says X, Y, Z. Then the other one says, well, but you forgot A, B, C. The guy says, yeah, you're right. Well, how about G, H, I? Well, I don't know about that. It looks
That's
to me
why.
Like we've reached the limits of our mathematization of things in economics. I wonder if you'd make a comment about that. I was brought up when I got in school, you know, we just plug the numbers in, don't worry about it. There's your answer, and that's what we'll do. It doesn't seem to be working that way anymore. I was wondering why. Thank you.
All right.
You'll notice that's why we have two economists here for you right now.
So we can have three answers. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. The question of how far math can go in economics is actually an extremely important question. And over the decades, there's been movements back and forth as more math has been brought in and then since that there's been an overreaction to it. I don't think you'll ever get to the point where you can do without the math, and I don't think you'll ever get to the point where you can do economics solely on the math. So I think that shuffling back and forth, more math, less math, is just an inevitable part of the process.
Well, you would think that economics is really all about numbers and that they're sort of they're fixed and they're reliable. And is that not the case, or what we're really talking about is analysis?
I think that's very much not the case. The economy is incredibly dynamic. It's changing all the time, and so we have to adapt models to keep up with that.
And so we can go back and say, oh, well, this business cycle looks like the one in 1981 or the one in 1907, but then we get to be like historians and say, on the other hand, no, there are some differences here. Look, it's going slower in this way or slower in that way. And so there's always a balancing act trying
well,
to decide.
Well, if you, say, take a very basic question, like, say, I ask the question, what sort of ability does the government, the federal government, have to influence the economy? And I guess the thing that we're talking about is economic stimulus. What can it do to bolster the economy? Is that something on which economists disagree whether or not the government has the power, or is the place where people would disagree in is on what the government should actually do?
Yeah, my take on that is that the government has the power, but should it do it? Right? There's a debate about that.
And I would say it probably has the power in the short run and probably doesn't have the power in the long run, and figuring out how to stop trying to do it is the tricky part of it.
Right. I mean, I think it's undeniable that in the most recent financial crisis and this recession, the Fed has intervened massively. I personally think that had the Fed not gotten involved during the financial meltdown, it would have,
it would have been a disaster or a bigger disaster than it was.
Exactly. So.
What about the idea of economic stimulus and whether government spending is a good thing and it gives a boost to the economy or no?
I guess the consensus is somewhere in the middle on that. In the short run, it can, and in the long run, it can't.
Right, and it clearly depends what you're spending on, right? So I think that's a big factor. So if the government is investing in certain things, so we're talking about, in that sense, economic growth. You know, there are certain things that I think economists agree promote economic growth. So investment in education, savings, so you have appropriate capital, things of that nature. But again, we go back to this cyclical. The Fed can't do anything about education, for example, right? But when there's a financial crisis and we're worried about illiquidity of institutions, the Fed can do something and did do something. Right? Now, the U.S. is also a very large country, so when the Fed gets involved in a market, it can affect interest rates. So, I mean, Charlie, you might want to say something about quantitative easing, what's been going on recently.
Well, the reductions in interest rates have been actually fairly dramatic in the U.S. over the last couple of years, and they've gotten to the point now that for short-term rates, they're down about as low as they can go, basically zero. And so the most recent actions by the Federal Reserve have been to try to bring down longer-term interest rates as well, and they've been doing that by purchasing longer-term securities as well. Part of the same program, but going out to move other interest rates besides the short-term ones.
Uh-huh. That's now, why is that good? It's not good for investors.
That's
certainly.
Right. If you're lending, it's a bad thing. If you're a borrower, it sounds like a good thing.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So the sense that you want to, first of all, there are two pieces to it. First of all, you think that it's a stimulative thing to do. If you're in the middle of a short term financial crisis, that's a good direction to go. Secondly, it encourages the lending, encourages general economic activity.
Mm. So the idea would be it makes it, if you want to borrow money for hopefully for something that will maybe create jobs, or maybe you just want to borrow money, then you're going to go out and spend it. And that is a good thing if we make it easier for people to borrow money.
Absolutely.
But even the U.S. government has this big and growing debt. So it makes it easier to finance that debt. The question is to what end, right? Mm-hmm. So presumably it's providing a bridge to get that structural deficit back in line. Right?
You wouldn't want to. You would hope the Fed wouldn't be doing it simply to make it cheaper for the government to do the borrowing, more to make it easier for the government to do borrowing for sensible things to borrow for.
Right, and solve this problem over time, because the point that you raised, how quickly do you adjust, is an important one. Right. So I think everybody understands adjustments need to occur. But the question is, where's that sustainable plan to bring expenditures back in line with the revenue we can raise?
All right. Well, we have several callers here. We have somebody who is on a cell phone here, so we want to try to get to them first. They're on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was just curious as to when you were talking about where to cut and talking about ways to change the deficit figure, why something like retirement age adjustment is often brought up versus cutting the spending that's going on with wars or end of life care in this country, the amount of expense that goes into that. I was just wondering why things like that are not brought up very often when you're talking about the deficit.
Oh, so I just meant to give one example. To solve this problem, I think a whole variety of things need to be on the table. So that was just meant as one example.
It's just curious to me that the defense spending, which is kind of really not a very good way to put it because it isn't really about defense. I'm not sure what it's about, but the wars. There's an incredible amount of money and resources that are poured into that, and then our healthcare system and the way money is spent with that. If we could take a look at that and revamp that, particularly end of life care. So those are things that are for the good of the people. Raising the retirement age, I'm not sure that's for really the good of the people. So I just am curious as to why always things are brought up such as raising the retirement age versus something that would really help the population. Just a comment.
All right. Well, and I have some other people here. I guess I think about the fact that probably one reason that when you're talking about cutting spending, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid come up is that those programs, mostly those, make up something like 60% of the budget, and that they're in those areas that are referred to as not being discretionary. They're obligations that we have, and that the concern is that out over time, as we have more and more people going into the retirement age, the demands on those systems, particularly Medicaid, or Medicare and Social Security, are going to grow, and that's something that we have to address because that's a big part of the structural deficit.
Right.
It's hard to imagine that you could do something about the structural deficit without doing something about those, but then there are plenty of other areas that you'd want to look at as well.
Right, yeah. And there are a lot of options within those programs. So I gave one example of people work in an extra year or some period of time, and you can see how over time that would bring a budget deficit, into line. But, it's possible to raise taxes. It's possible to cut benefits. Right? So there are a lot of different options. But,
right.
They are all painful.
And everyone will have a different view as to which one is the one that is most ripe for cutting. And that's probably where the difficulty comes in trying to figure out how to cut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go to Spring Bay. Another caller here. Line two. Hello. Yes.
I've heard that our current economic problems are partially as a result of a lack of demand, that there's plenty of stuff out there available, but the demand has dried up. And so to talk about cutting seems to me to be a little bit putting the cart before the horse in terms of we've got 9.8% unemployment. We need to get people back to work to create demand to get things moving again. So my question would be, at 9.8%, if we were able to, let's say, get that down to the 2 to 3% range, and also then maybe do some cuts, they've already decided to do it in the military, how would those two factors working together start to put us back on the road of recovery? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks for the good
right.
program.
So that is the nature of a recession. You're absolutely right that that demand goes down. And we had a stimulus package. And And so some of that added to our debt in terms of expenditures. Just yesterday, there was an outline of a discussion or an agreement to not raise taxes. Right? And so that there are expenditures associated with that. And that's very much what we're talking about, that the difference between a cyclical and structural deficit, that mm-hmm. these are cyclical measures that we're taking so that the economy doesn't fall further, but we have to pay for them. So it's very much this idea of things that are happening in the short run versus in the long run, how are we going to deal with the debt over time?
Another caller here. We'll go to line number three. This is someone here in Champaign County where we are. Hello.
Hi. One thing I wanted to address is there was a point made that the consensus is that that there is a consensus on something. I don't think there's a consensus on anything in economics. I mean, Nixon said we're all Keynesians now, but we're not. I think one of your panelists there has actually said that she doesn't advocate government intervention in some way. Maybe she says it's a short-term necessary evil. But the point I wanted to make is I hope you do have Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot on. They wrote the Social Security Reform Crisis, which should not be on the table at all. And, it's interesting that the DeConcini, Rivlin commission or whatever they were, self-appointed or otherwise, argued for a value-added tax, whereas nothing in the commission itself, the so-called appointed one, offered anything new in the way of taxing in the modern age. I think the tax on transactions, which is being used in a number of countries and a number of countries to protect their currencies, like Brazil, is something that ought to come up. But, of course, the corporate vested interests that are actually represented in these commissions, both of them, and probably in the next one that comes down too, aren't going to suggest that, even though there is this old saw about taxation that tax something that you don't want. Well, I don't think many people would say we want this kind of volatility in the high-speed transactions that are going on now. That anything that would slow them down and raise some revenue would be admirable in itself on that scale. So it just seems to me that, we have the Austrian school, which says everything will just work out with the free market. And people are still seriously offering that spike back to Greenspan. Is questioning his ideology, though I think it's sneaking back in. I think the discussion should be much broader, and maybe we should even have some of the graduates of the economics department who are using everything they learned here as a cautionary tale of what not to do, like Correa and Ecuador and this new Brazilian guy who is going to join the new government there. There's a much broader range of possibilities, I think, to look at than this myopic focus on the deficit. Social Security doesn't have anything to do with the structural deficit, really. I mean, if you look at the projections given by the Social Security Commission themselves, it would take a depression rate of growth for 30 years to deflate it. The real crisis is medical care. And that needs to be addressed in a much more creative fashion than has been evinced so far. And there are good examples of that elsewhere as well. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, the caller has put a lot of things on the table. Any of that in particular that you'd like to respond to?
On the question of how creative do you want to be about changing a tax system, I think there are lots of interesting arguments for both transactions taxes and value-added taxes. My guess is that it's going to be pretty difficult to get any major change like that through a legislature in a democracy. So I think that in many of these schemes, there's many of these plans, there's always going to be a compromise between what's desirable on a theoretical basis and what's feasible politically.
Well, maybe we should talk about what a value-added tax is. It's something that a lot of other countries have, and we don't. What is a value-added tax?
A value-added tax is a kind of a sales tax. It's a sales tax which is modified by allowing individual businesses to get credit for the part of the monies that were expended by them in making the goods in the first place. So as a sales tax would be a tax on the whole value of the item, a value-added tax says, well, yes, but you get credit back for whatever it is you had to buy to get the value-added tax in the first place. So the original reason for these things to exist in the countries that had them is actually a historical accident, because they were about how to collect the revenues. Mm-hmm. If you can't trust your business to actually give you the tax revenues, then suddenly they had an incentive to keep track of whether other people were giving you the revenues, because they kept track of all the purchases that they had made and whether the taxes had been paid on those things, so that they could get credit for that when they made their own taxes. It was mm-hmm. a way of having an automatic inspection, an automatic check to make sure that the taxes were being paid every step along the way.
And I think some of the interest by some people is that it taxes consumption, not labor.
And also not savings, which is also...
And not say, yes. Right. And in fact, it encourages people to save more, presumably.
Right. Right. And so that's all good things and all great arguments for it. But it's sort of hard to imagine that anyone's going to be willing to change a tax system uh-huh. to that extreme, in that extreme a way.
And is it? I think I also have the idea that somehow the value-added tax is something that is most that comes into play most when you're talking about an item that is very expensive. Is that true, or is that really
No. You notice it, of course, when you're talking about.
Okay.
But you notice the sales tax when you're talking about buying a car, not so much
right.
when you're talking about that.
Right, right. I think a lot of it is this focus on more consumption in general.
Our guests here in this hour of focus are Charles Kahn and Anne Villamel. Charles Kahn is a professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. Anne Villamel is professor of economics and finance in the College of Business. And here we're talking about current economic issues. We started out talking about deficit and debt. And as I tried to explain at the beginning of the program, what we are hoping to do here on the show is some number of shows with a number of guests. And we're certainly open to suggestions on topics or guests. But we want to try to talk about some basic issues. And I thought that right now one of the things that's on everybody's mind now, the issues of deficit and debt. So if you have questions, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We want to have a slight clarification as to your departmental identification?
Right. We both have joint appointments between economics and finance.
And finance is actually in arts and sciences now.
Oh, really?
No, economics.
Economics is. Sorry.
All right.
Dual loyalties makes for complicated existence.
That's makes right. it almost as clear as the things that we've already been talking about. Very good. Well, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Another caller here, someone on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes. Hi.
I know that... you know, your topic is deficit and debt, and I hope it's okay to ask a question about something that I think is related, a
sure.
little different, and that is to maybe ask the guest to comment on what they think is maybe more important or more threatening, deficit debt or the prosperity gap, which is something that, you know, a lot of progressive researchers have been talking about for a couple decades, but has only become a little bit more apparent, maybe more mainstream. So that's one question. And the second question has to do with sort of the role of ideology versus data. And I'd like to maybe ask a question, if I can make it more general, about behavioral economics, because it feels like a lot of the arguments that have been made on both sides have been more ideology-driven than they have been based on data. And I wonder if your guests think that that might be the case, and what would we do about it, if there's anything that we could do about it?
So let me first address the issue of the prosperity gap. I assume by that you mean, you know, the widening in the income distribution. Right? So
incomes also, but assets and also things like tax policy and, you know, sort of the benefits that are given to people who already really have a lot of resources, say mortgage deductions on second homes for people who don't even have one home. I mean, you know, it's sort of a disparity that I see. You may not, but I do.
No. I mean, it's a fact that the income and the wealth distributions are widening, right? So that
yes, it is. I mean, the data demonstrates that, and it demonstrates also that you know, in general, it's not really good. It's like if you look at how the United States compares on a number of international indicators of the health of a nation, we're declining. We have been for 30 or 40 years. Mm-hmm. And that coincides, not necessarily causation, of course, but it coincides with some policies that have seemed to me to have benefited people who already have assets and have wealth and made people that don't have those resources fall farther behind. And as a nation, is that really good in the long term?
Right. But those are political decisions that need to be made. They're not economic decisions per se. So, for example,
don't you think they're based on data? I mean, does the data not support that?
Well, I mean, the data indisputably supports the fact that the income and the wealth distributions are widening.
Right. We know that.
Right. So yes. I mean, the data establish that fact, but it's really a political view that people have to decide what they want to do about it. That's not an economic decision per se.
Right, which is kind of why I asked the second question, is about the role of ideology / politics versus, you know, people really being able to look at what information tells them and make really rational decisions about, you know, what are the facts of the situation versus, you know, what kind of rhetorical points do we want to score? And where do we want to go? And who benefits ultimately? That's kind of the question. And a long-term versus a short-term perspective.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, though, that you say in terms of behavioral economics, because behavioral economics mostly talks about that at the level not of decisions by society, but of decisions by individuals.
Right. Micro, not macro.
Right. Exactly. Right. And so I was a little confused about whether behavioral economics came into that issue.
I think part of the reason is because when individuals in a democracy make their decisions about what they think is beneficial, maybe for them and their families and maybe for the society as a whole, it's very difficult, I think. We're full of information and, you know, we don't really have the best education system for people to understand how to use data. And so, you know, frequently developers' positions based on value systems or belief systems or rhetorical, you know, better talking points by one or the other side. I just think that you can't take that away from the discussion of the whole, you know, macro discussion of economics. And I know it's larger than deficit and debt, but that's part of it, I think. You may disagree. That's okay, too.
I guess I do disagree with you in the following sense. The questions that you're asking about which direction a society should go are probably the fundamental questions, the most important ones to be addressed. And the questions that we're looking at are, in fact, a little narrower than that. In the sense that we're simply asking the question of, if you're in the middle of an economic recession, what kinds of things can you do to get out of it? Those questions are, in fact, difficult as they sound, probably much easier to get a handle around than the ones that you want to be addressing.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm personally very concerned about both deficit debt, because I do think it's important, even though personally I'm pretty progressive in my politics. I agree with people who are on the other side about that concern. But I also, you know, have watched, you know, the future for my child become much more bleak than my future was, and even more bleak than my parents' future was. And I think we really need to confront that fact and to sort of look at the indicators that tell us how our nation is really falling behind because we don't make the right investments. And I think part of the reason is, well, it's just very complicated, like you say. But I appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, I thank you for the call. I guess what frustrates the caller, maybe what frustrates me, is sometimes in talking about these issues or in hearing people talk about them, is that it seems like there probably aren't very many economists who are agnostics. Politically speaking, you know, you have conservative economists, you have liberal economists, and they're going to have very fundamental differences, maybe even on what the big questions are. But even if they do agree on what the important issues are, there is going to be a lot of disagreement on what to do about it, you know, how we fix those things, like income inequality, as you say, as the caller points out, that's a fact. Then the question is, well, maybe one question would be, is that a problem or not? And then if you decide that is a problem, what do you do about that?
And if you are interested in working on a question like what should you do about a deficit, and you can get to an agreement that over the long haul there should be something done about it, then the political fight will immediately begin, depending upon your political views, of whether the best way of going about that is by changing the taxes or by changing the spending. You might even get a whole spectrum of economists to agree that over the long haul the deficit should be reduced, and then get into a Donnybrook almost immediately as they divide up along party lines as to how to do that.
Well, let me ask you a question here. This is an email question that's come in, and I think it connects with this, and the caller is wanting to know the solution to what the problems we're talking about here is really the solution, growth. That is in the words of the caller here, or the person who's listening, is nonstop economic growth in the sense of ever-increasing GDP the solution to our economic problems? Or, now here we can get into the politics, is a more distributed, more distributive justice an essential condition to the solution? So that's the issue. Is it growth or is
it
distribution?
I mean, to phrase that question slightly differently, it is it the size of the pie or your slice of it, right? So so if we have growth, then the pie is growing, and it makes it easier to give everybody a bigger slice. So growth is certainly a good thing. You know, we're growing. We've come off a very severe recession, and we're growing very slowly. So it would be great if the pie were, you know, suddenly growing more quickly, but that's not happening right now. And so that focuses more this idea of who gets which slice.
Also, if you've been living through a couple of decades of reasonably fast growth, it becomes easy to devalue the importance of growth. But after a couple of years of shrinkage, then growth suddenly seems like a really good thing again.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk at illinois.edu. Our guests are Charles Kahn and Ann Villamil, and they are professors of economics and finance here at the University of Illinois. We'll go on to line two, Urbana. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to get back to what a caller earlier raised about the concentration of wealth. And I don't believe that is dissociated from politics. And in fact, I'd like to find out your comments on whether we really have government by the wealthy, as we see the increasing and really untethered now ability of the wealthy to dictate government. And also, I'd like your comments on the necessity that lowering interest rates is a good thing. There's also a downside to that, and that is that people are not saving money, and if they are, they're not accruing wealth that way. And lastly, where is all the wealth going since the banks aren't lending the money and the people in the top 1% don't seem to be investing the money within the United States? Where's all the wealth going?
All right, so let me take a crack at least the first two. So in terms of wealth policy, you know, we can have a big effect on who gets what by how progressive, for example, an income tax system is. If we raise tax rates on higher income individuals, so you know, if we make that decision, that will have an effect on the wealth distribution. That's one way to have an effect on it. So that's the first point.
Inheritance taxes as well.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So those are policy choices that we can make. In terms of lowering interest rates, you know, you raised a question about saving. Actually, in fact, savings rates are going up in the U.S. So despite the fact that interest rates are low.
You're right that one thing that ought to influence degree of savings is how tempting the interest rates are. But the thing that turns out to be even more influential, at least over the last couple of years, is feelings of security or insecurity,
right,
and a sense of how much debt people have been accumulating. It's a question of if that debt's gotten out of line with their abilities to handle it. And that's really where the increase in savings has come from probably in the last couple of years.
Yeah, saving rates were actually, prior to the recession, at historic lows. In the U.S. And, you know, as Charlie was saying, some of that might have made sense. If your portfolio was going up, you didn't need to save as much to achieve your retirement goals. But then when the stock market went down, when people are concerned about their jobs, they've chosen, again, to save more despite the lower interest rates.
And I suppose that also some people would make the argument that the reason that we weren't saving was it was somehow a coupling of the lack of growth in earning power that a lot of people had over decades, coupled with the availability of easy credit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people really weren't spending and why they were accumulating so much debt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and, of course, all those arguments say, well, when the interest rates are down like they are right now, even easier to accumulate debt, but that's pushing. We're pushing against a bigger force, which is the general decline in the economic situation in the last couple of years.
We'll see if we can get at least one more call in the time that remains, maybe two. Next is in line is Normal, line three. Hello.
Thank you. Great show. I've heard of an idea that's been thrown out there, and I was thinking of like a new twist of it. I mean, I think a great policy change would be to have where the Federal Reserve, where they are dependent upon Congress for their cash supplies. You know, because like they said, like that one instance, I guess Bernanke or somebody, they've got a special login code pass or whatever.
Yeah.
They go in there, they just add zeros to their balance sheet. I think it'd be nice if they go to Congress and be like, hey, we need some more cash here to keep the economy going. Can you stock us? And then, like what the Constitution say. What do you think about that?
I think we need a new program to start on this one. I think this one is a fascinating one. I guess I have to disagree with you pretty strongly on that, but it would take a new program, a new hour to talk about that in detail. So maybe they'll invite us back and we can do it again.
Right, but there's a very strong tradition of Fed independence. It's not exactly like the Supreme Court, but it is this idea that you want the Fed to make decisions on economic grounds, not political grounds.
And I think, in fact, the last couple of years have shown the value of that in the difference between how well the Fed has responded to the crisis and some of the problems that have arisen in the Congress during the same time.
Right. I agree. I mean, monetary policy has been operating. People might, you know, disagree with it on certain in certain respects, but it's fiscal policy, the ability to bring expenditures and taxes into line that we're not making a lot of progress on.
We'll try to get to one more caller. Sullivan, line four. Hello.
Yeah. What amazes me is that something like 5% of the people pay something like 60% of the income tax or whatever. And the other thing is that, you know, like Japan, kids get home from school and then they go back to school to try to get an education. Therefore, they make more money. And over here in the United States, we get out of school and we go play baseball, goof off, roller skate, skateboard, or whatever. Seems like we just do not want to get an education and move ourselves up the system. Thank you, sir.
Well, I'm not sure about the second part. I suppose the first part is one of those things that people point to when they actually argue for against raising taxes on the wealthiest people, because they say they're already paying the when you look at how much of the taxes wealthy people pay and how much taxes everybody else pay, they say they're already paying a big chunk of what's coming in.
Well, but that's when you look at absolute numbers versus proportions, right? I mean, it's, you know, very much like Charlie's point about the VAT. That, you know, if you buy something that's very expensive, you say, gee, I paid a big amount, but it's helpful to look at these things in percentage terms, right? And the second thing is back to education, and let me just relate that to the growth point. Education is very important. If you want to have long-term economic growth, you know, that is an area of concern.
Yeah. Well, for now, we're going to have to stop because we've simply come to the end of the time for this show. But we promise we will take up there are more things we could talk about. We could talk about these same things with some other economists who have different points of view, and we'll try to do as much of that as we possibly can. And certainly in the meantime, if people who are listening have thoughts about issues they'd like us to take up, people they'd like us to have on the program, we're always open to suggestions, and we'll see if we can have some more discussion of these issues. But for right now, we need to stop and say thanks to our guests, Charles Kahn and Anne Villamil. They're professors of finance and economics here at the University of Illinois. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.